Okay, yeah, well, basically, you know, can the king be justified in rejecting his guru? It's a serious matter. We heard what the king is promising. You know, if I ever become unfriendly to you, then I'm ruined. So it has to be strong justification for rejecting the guru, especially for a king to reject his guru. Because that's not just private business, that's the welfare of the whole country at stake. It's not just his life, it's the life of all the citizens that are going to be affected by this. So only in drastic situations. And it would have to be in consultation. There's not only one Brahmin, there's not only one priest, but a king has a Brahminical council, so he has to consult with his council and with the other respected Brahmins before taking such a drastic measure, normally. Because we had the one case of Bali Maharaj. Shukracharya, his priest, same situation, told him, don't give these three steps to this boy. That's Vishnu. You know, he's your enemy. And he refused to obey his guru. And his guru cursed him. And because of that, rejected him and cursed him. So that's exceptional situation. That should not be imitated by anybody else. Without consulting with other Brahmins to reject your guru. And even if you're not a king, you shouldn't try to find some easy excuse to dump your guru if you feel like you'd like some different one. Everybody has a guru. Even Krishna and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted gurus. What looks like an exception is Shukadeva Goswami. He didn't take initiation from anybody. But again, that shouldn't be imitated. But he didn't take initiation. He never was initiated. But he took instruction from Vyasadeva. He accepted Vyasadeva as Shiksha Guru. So otherwise, anybody who's an Aryan, who's making progress in spiritual life, has to have a guru. Not just Chaitya Guru. It has to be combined effort of the inside and outside gurus. Guru Krishna Prashade Pai Bhakti Vata Pich. By the combined mercy of the outside guru and the Chaitya Guru on the inside, one gets the seed of devotion awakened in his heart. Without that, you can't get proper guidance. You have to have a guru, no matter who you are. Even if you're God, you set the example by accepting a guru. Who was it? Indra ran up, got in trouble kidnapping somebody's wife, and he was, he got a sinful curse and got a sinful reaction. He had to leave heaven and was hiding in a lotus pond, and then there was, and the demigods were without a king, so they looked down on the earth and they saw there's what's his name? Nahusha. Best available kshatriya on the earth, and they installed him as Indra. So actually, it was Brihaspati, the Brahmin priest of the demigods, who advised them to take this Nahusha, this earthling, and turn him into the king of heaven. So by the advice and empowerment of the priest of the demigods, this ordinary king became a demigod. Then he showed his earthly failings, and he tried to enjoy Indra's wife, and then he got in trouble. He was kicked out. So the same Brahmins can make someone, an ordinary person, into a deity and make him back into an ordinary person again. Yes. Shukadev, Anipeta. He never took initiation. He's a speaker of the Bhagavatam, but he never had initiation. Uninitiated bhakta. Bhakta Shukadev. But he heard the Bhagavatam. He listened. He took shiksha from Vyasadeva. He's the exception. Otherwise, every bona fide Vaishnava has taken it. It's a thing you do. You take initiation. Even if it's a formality, but it's a formality that everybody follows. even if you have a much more intense relationship with your Shiksha Guru, still you always have a Shiksha Diksha Guru. You always take initiation, you always give respect to your Diksha Guru. Even if you get most of your instruction from somebody else. Or even if you're God and you don't need any instruction.
Let's look at 25. Prajapati sutat sangran manur vikyat mangbalaha brahmavartam yodivasan shasti saptarnava mahim.
So Vishnu is not simply trying to pacify Kardama and tell him some philosophy just to keep him quiet, but he's going to get down to business here and show how he's actually arranging for the fulfillment of Kardama's desires. So he says, Lord Vishnu says, the emperor, Swayambhuva Manu, son of Lord Brahma, who is well known for his righteous acts, has his seat in Brahmavarta and rules over the earth with its seven oceans. So now Vishnu introduces Swayambhuva Manu. Why? What business does a rishi have to do with the king? But this is the answer to Kardama's his ambition. So Prajapati Sutta, he's the son of the original Prajapati, Brahma, and he's emperor of the whole earth. And he's very famous, not for conquering or for being a giver of charity, but for his auspicious personality, his saintly personality. Vikyata Mangalaha. Prabhupada explains, in the word-for-word synonyms, Prabhupada translates mangala as righteous acts, or in the translation it says righteous acts. Then in the purport, he explains more thoroughly his mangala, or the auspiciousness of Swayambhuva Manu, is the opulences of his religious performances, his ruling power, his cleanliness, and his other good qualities. So these are the good qualities of a kshatriya. Here's our prototype kshatriya. He's the first ruler of human society. Before that, there were only demigods. He's the first leader of human society. All the human beings are the descendants of Manu, Manuja. Manuja means human being, born from Manu. So Manu is the first human being. He's the first king of all human. He's the first human kshatriya. So he displays the perfect qualities of a kshatriya. And they're not the same as the perfect qualities of a Brahmin. We read from the Shataputta Brahmana yesterday. Brahmin, by his austerities, his intelligence becomes pure, and he develops four good qualities. He takes a good birth. He behaves very properly. He has a spotless reputation. He has influence because of his honesty. And he's able to elevate the population by his instructions. Now, kshatriya has four good qualities mentioned here by Prabhupada in the purport, but they're different. They also benefit society, but in a different way. He performs religious sacrifices, opulent sacrifices. By performance of big sacrifices, the whole population is benefited. If you perform a sacrifice in your house, that'll benefit your family. But if you perform a big sacrifice, that'll benefit everybody. The king sacrifices, and he can, if he's righteous, he can perform them nicely. He has ruling power. That's not a quality of a Brahmin. Brahmins don't try to control anybody. But the kshatriya's business is to control. And that's his glory, is that he can control other people. But righteously. He's clean. Not just he takes a shower, but he's clean in his behavior, in his thought, in his words. And he has other good qualities. So, anyway, that's how Swayambhuva Manu is auspicious. It's auspicious in a different way than Kardama. He celebrated, where does that word come? Celebrated, famous, popular. The king should not be anonymous. know, you shouldn't keep a low key. A king has to be very prominent and have charisma and be loved by the people to be effective. Whereas, on the other hand, Brahmins are more anonymous. They're not out for reputation. Well, they want to have influence. They want to help society and have their instructions heard. But they're not out for their own reputation, for being worshipped on their own. Brahmins are more anonymous. So that's why in the Bhagavatam is stories about Vishnu, about the Supreme Person, Bhagavan, and about the Bhagavats. Bhagavatam is a book about Bhagavan and Bhagavats, the Lord and his devotees. You would think that the Brahmins should be the best devotees. And they are. The Brahmins are pure. Kshatriyas are more passionate. Then why is the Bhagavatam filled with stories about kings? Count how many, there's a couple of thousand, 3,000 kings described in the Bhagavatam, how many Brahmins? A few hundred. And then don't hear much about the Brahmins. Brahmins are more anonymous. And also, you know, to us in the modern world, the exploits of kings are more interesting to hear about. You know, he did this and he did that, so many amazing things. Got into trouble this way and that way. And the Brahmins, they just sit and meditate and go back to God. They're not much interesting to describe. So the Brahminical life is more anonymous, more simple. And the life of a king is more glorious. It makes more interesting history. Okay. One last verse, and then I want to propose a topic for discussion. Maybe tomorrow we can have a debate on this. Verse 26. There's no purport to 26, but I'll read the verse.
Sacheha vipra rajarshir mahishya shatarupaya ayasyati didrikshus twam parashvo dharmako vidaha.
So Lord Vishnu tells him, quite frankly, the day after tomorrow, O Brahman, that celebrated emperor who is expert in religious activities will come here with his queen, Shatarupa, wishing to see you. Okay. So, Lord Vishnu says that Manu is a Rajarshi, and he's very expert in religious principles. Kshatriyas also know Dharma. They also are trained up in the Vedas to understand the principles of religion, but in their own way. You know, Kshatriya gets a Vedic education, but not to the same extent as a Brahmin. He learns especially the duties of a king and the principles of religion in relationship to human society, whereas a Brahmin goes more into depth into the essence of religion. And a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, he may learn so many, he may get so much of a Vedic education, he may be able to chant mantras, even perform sacrifices, a Kshatriya. But he can't be independent from the Brahmins. He always has to rely on their guidance. To be a Kshatriya means to be involved with the mode of passion. To sometimes have a hot head. And therefore you have to be guided. If you're a hot-headed Kshatriya, you have to be guided and tempered by the cool-headed Brahmins, who are not involved in politics. It's always like that. The Kshatriyas depend on the guidance, on the support of the Brahmins, to keep them under control. A Kshatriya without guidance will be misdirected and unruly. Okay, so that's the basic point. We'll discuss more about that later. Here I'd like to open up a discussion. How is this relevant to the current situation of Islam? Okay. Here's my argument. Okay. So I'm arguing, you know, from one point that there's nothing wrong. You know, because aren't the leaders of our society, they're all following Prabhupada. They're very sincere devotees. They're the most sincere devotees among us. They've dedicated their lives to Prabhupada. Why should we propose, you know, someone else is proposing, I'm arguing against it, that we have to have a separate political function in ISKCON? This is being discussed now by the GBC. And they're talking about right now about proposals set up a special brahminical council for the GBC. So I'm arguing, why is that necessary? But I'm proposing if we discuss this tomorrow. Now think about it. We'll start a debate tomorrow. And you choose what side you'd like to argue. Yeah. The question then is, do we actually need in ISKCON to establish a separate dominical voice, like a separate community of Brahmins to give advice? Do we really need that, because aren't we taking advice from Prabhupada? So the question is this Vedic system relevant to ISKCON or not? And you can take your side and argue. Give reasons. Have an opinion, but then also back it up. Okay, we'll ask everybody tomorrow what side you want to argue from, and we'll split the class if you sit on this side or that side. Okay. Any question? Yes. Yes. That's the day of the Varaha Kalpa. Yes. Which one is Varaha Kalpa? We're in the Shweta Varaha Kalpa now, actually. And as far as I understand, I'm sorry? I think that's the current day of Brahma, the one we're living in now. Because as far as I understand, this narration of the second half of the third canto, or the whole third canto, was occurring in the current day of Brahma. Whereas what was described in the first two cantos was the very first day of Brahma. No, way back. Yeah, back in the beginning of his life. And now Brahma is middle-aged. He's 50 years old now. And we're in his 50th year at about 10:30 in the morning on a certain day. And it's called the Shweta Varaha Kalpa. It's the day of Brahma in which Lord Varaha appears in his white form. Sometimes Varaha appears in different days of Brahma, but he has different colors. So white Varaha appears in this day. And it's called the Shweta Varaha Kalpa. You can be a Brahminically inclined Kshatriya or an administrative Brahmana. You have many of both. Look at Yudhishthira. He's a Kshatriya, but practically a Brahmana. You know, he doesn't like to fight. He doesn't want to rule. He'd like to sit and talk to Brahmins and perform sacrifices. If he had his choice, he'd be a Brahmin, but he's a Kshatriya. So his passion is very much mixed up with goodness. And then you've got Brahmins who are very much involved in politics. They're basic political nature, but there's a lot of passion there. So you have many cases of there's no fifth Varna there, but there's borderline Brahmins and Kshatriyas who are mixed. It's useful. You know, a government needs Brahmins, Brahminical advisors. If a government can engage Brahmins in helping administer, that's very useful. Brahmins make good administrators. But you also need ideal Brahmins. You can't have all the Brahmins mixed up in passion. So who's going to be the original teachers? You need some Brahmins to stay in the ashrams, in the forest, and stay aloof from politics. You need some pure Brahmins, otherwise human society is without a head. If all the Brahmins get involved in the government service, then the world goes to hell. Okay, so we can stop here. Think a bit about what you want to, what position you want to take, and we'll discuss tomorrow about this question. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. So Manu, as Lord Vishnu is predicting, day after tomorrow, Swayambhu Manu is going to visit you. He's going to offer his daughter to you in marriage. As Manu himself and the other sages in their Dharma Shastras explain, there are different kinds of marriages. Prabhupada discusses how in the Vedic system, girls don't independently pick their husbands. Girls are not just sent out in the streets to become prostitutes to go hunt for a husband. That's modern life. Even a respectable girl has to become a prostitute. She has to sell her body to get a husband. We think this is civilization, but it's not. So in the civilization of the Varnashram system, a girl is protected by her parents until she's married. And the parents take the responsibility to arrange her marriage. But there are different kinds of marriages that are sanctioned by the Dharma Shastras. The Brahma Vivaha, brahminical marriage, is the first kind. This is what's being arranged right now. Brahminical. Maybe someone could mention we're having a class. Okay. Brahminical marriage means the parents arrange it. The father of the daughter is giving the daughter as a gift. You know, offering the daughter to as a gift to the groom. And along with the gift comes a dowry. And she's a gift, so she comes also with presents for her. The dowry belongs to the girl when she's married. But there are other kinds of marriage also. We hear about Gandharva marriage. Just like Krishna met Kalindi, Jamuna personified, and they just decided to get married. She said, I'm waiting for you to become my husband. And Krishna says, okay. So in the Gandharva marriage, the man and wife just of their own choice agree to become husband and wife, and they simply garland one another, and that's it, they're married. Then there's the Rakshasa marriage. Krishna also got married that way. His first marriage to Rukmini. When a prince kidnaps a princess and has to fight off all the other suitors, there's a battle, that's Rakshasa marriage. And there's others. Pishacha marriage. Pishachas are ghosts, so that's the lowest form of marriage. If you just rape a woman in her sleep. I've mentioned also, it's considered abominable. It's not sanctioned. So parents make the arrangement, but there are circumstances under which, not independently, but according to the principles of religion, the girl makes her own choice. Like a princess who's very exalted, she may be given a swayamvara. Not every king's daughter, but special daughters, specially qualified princesses, are given swayamvara. They have a ceremony where she makes her own choice among all the suitors. And there's also a prescription that a father has to get his daughter married before puberty. This is the rule. So, according to Manusamhita, if a girl reaches puberty, if she has 3 menstrual periods, if she reaches a puberty and waits and 3 more months pass, and she hasn't, her marriage has not been arranged, she can go get her own husband. Yeah. And her father, is going to have to suffer severe reactions from that. Anyway, the kind of marriage is being arranged for Kardama, the offering made by Swayambhuva Manu, this is a first class brahminical marriage. So this sheet is sign-up sheet for the debate. Only if you want to speak. If you want to speak, then sign. If you just want to listen, don't sign it. Okay, I think everybody has gotten their chance to sign. Anyway, we do have some on the north side. Okay, so we'll give everybody 4 or 5 minutes to speak, and then if anybody else has comments or rebuttals, we could, after we've gone down the list. We only have 2 on the no side and 6 on the yes side. Okay, so question. Does the management of ISKCON need separate rabbinical advisors to guide it? Okay, so let's be polite in this debate. We don't need to criticize anybody in person. Yeah. Well, this is not the purpose of it, to vent our grudges, which we're trying to make a positive investigation into what's needed. So I can ask Nitai Ramdas if he'd like to speak for a few minutes on the yes side. Yes? Okay, you don't want. Yeah, okay. Your name was on the top. Anybody want to speak first on the yes side? Hey, Mahaprabhu Das, maybe. I'm sorry, what's your name? Oh, yes. Yeah,
maybe we don't punish anybody. That would punish serious spirits. But, you know, the equivalent of violence, spiritual leadership would be ostracism. And the ultimate punishment is you're out of the community. They have nothing to do with it. So that ostracism can be kind of violence. It can be an effective punishment. One who has that power over the community to decide who's allowed to stay and who has to go out, I think you can function as a jungle without actually killing anybody.
How do you reconcile these notions with the fact that we all understand that there's no material atonement to receive, only a spiritual process that truly
that's from a spiritual point of view.
But if we're living in a larger society and a crime is committed, you know, then the government might want us to turn over the criminal. So there are other levels on which criminal activity have to be dealt with. From the spiritual point of view, yes, you're freed from going to hell. Don't worry about that. If you just chant Hare Krishna, you're relieved of your sin. But if you went and shoplifted and you get caught, then you're going to have to spend some time in jail. Why not? The members of the committee would have to agree voluntarily to accept that. You can't just impose it. Right, that's the Bhakta program. I'm sorry, but you wanted to continue with your own yes proposals. Yeah. Yeah, please go ahead.
Chapter 4, text 13. Krishna is saying, according to the 3 modes of material nature and the work associated with them, the 4 divisions of human society are created by me. And although I am the creator of the system, we should know that I am yet the non-doer of the action. So the first point is that Krishna created the system. It's not that it's actually created by Krishna himself, so it must be some reason to create it.
Yes.
So, let's go to the other one, 1847. Sorry, that one. It is better to engage in one's own occupation, even though one may perform it imperfectly, than to accept another's occupation and perform it perfectly. Duties prescribed according to one's nature are never affected by sinful actions. So, what Krishna seems to be instructing Arjuna to take up the role of kshatriya. And if Arjuna is a beautiful leader. So if Krishna is instructing his pure devotee to be faithful to his duty, then
even if we don't need it, even if, okay, we're all practicing Vaishnavas, if we're not perfect yet, we'll soon be perfect, and a pure devotee is better than a Brahmin already. Therefore, why does he have to consider being anything else but a Vaishnava Brahmin? Still, Krishna tells Arjuna that, you know, yad yad acharati shreshtas tat tat eve tarojana, the rest of the people are going to follow the example of the leaders in society, the spiritual leaders. So, therefore, we lokasangvanam evapi, just in order to set an example for the populace, we have to accept these material designations, because most people have to. Many people can't come up to the standard of sadhana bhakti. They can't follow that. Many people cannot follow the rules and regulations. Therefore, they can't, nowadays, they can't fully join ISKCON. They're outsiders. But if ISKCON incorporates the Varnashram system, then there's scope for many other people to be participants according to their capacity. But they have to accept material roles in order to do that. And if the devotees accept the material roles, at least, even if they don't need it for themselves, at least to set the example for everybody else, that makes it possible for many, many people, many more people to participate in Krishna consciousness. What's the difference between ordinary Varnashram and Daivi Varnashram is that the Daivi element is that it's led. That Daivi Varnashram system is led by pure devotees. Now there's the intelligence of pure devotees directing the system. So when the devotees, those practicing pure devotional service, participate in the Vedic social system, then the system becomes spiritual. That's Daivi Varnashram. Did you want to say something else? Anyone else want to add something? Yes? Well, I mean, Prabhupada commented on that in 1974. He said that immediately every single temple in ISKCON should establish a Varnashram college. That the temple should get in the business of training up Kshatriyas and others. It's Prabhupada's instruction. Immediately, he said. The Varnas and the Ashrams? Yes, except for there's limitations on who can be a sannyasi, vanaprastha, brahmachari. Initiated Vaishnava can become a sannyasi, but in the traditional system, only a Brahmin can become a sannyasi, not a kshatriya. Kshatriya can take vanaprastha, but not sannyasi. But yeah, if you've got Vaishnav Diksha, then you're qualified as a Brahmin. You're allowed to take sannyas, even if you weren't born as a Brahmin. That's okay. But anyway, the traditional system is sannyas is only for Brahmins. Vanaprastha is only for Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Brahmacharya is only for the three classes that have sacred thread initiation. You know, the Shudras who don't take Upanayanam, they don't become Brahmacharis. Brahmachari life begins with Upanayana, actually. And then for the Shudras, there's only one ashram, Grihastha ashram. Yeah, but it's not for Shudras. Yeah. Or even among the Brahmins, there's variations, just like. You know, some of the caste Goswamis in Vrindavan. the families are the, you know, the family heads are the acharyas, and they get to all the sons all get initiation. It's part of, you know, entering the family business. But, you know, they shave their heads and that's it. You know, they're brahmacharya for one day. Yes. Well, Kshatriya spends a few, you know, several years, maybe not as many years as a Brahmin in the Gurukul, but he goes to Gurukul for several years also to get a thorough training. Kshatriyas need thorough, you know, spiritual discipline to become proper Kshatriyas. So Lord Ramachandra went to Vishishtha Rishi's ashram for several years. They were teenagers by the time they finished their education. A Brahmin spends more time. If you want to get complete Vedic education, if you want to study all four Vedas, 12 years for each Veda, 48 years in school. That's actually mentioned in Dharmashastra, theoretically. Yeah. The limit for Vedic education is up to 48 years. Okay. Yes?
I had a couple of comments.
Please.
See, first thing is that the way the question is formulated, I'm not sure if that's the right or the only way to formulate it.
Okay.
These club managers need a separate rabbinical body to guide them.
Yes.
So it's not really clear what is separate from what. As far as I understand, one aspect of this issue which has been discussed is the role of the GPC itself.
Yes.
Some people say that just like Prabhupada shifted from having only Grihasthas to the GPC,
yes,
doing sannyasis,
yes,
and there are letters in which he says, now in words, I want the GPC to do as I'm doing, traveling and teaching,
yes,
more like a Brahminical role.
Yes.
So one side of the issue is saying that the GPC itself should just be a Brahminical role, and the managing should be something below the GPC. Some other type of body, some other type of definition. Also, due to the fact that Prabhupada also apparently spoke about the limit of the number of GPCs that we should have, and practically, it'd be just too much, the zone would be just too big, too large for few GPCs to manage.
Yes.
So, it seems that the issue actually is that the role of the GPC itself should be a Brahminical.
Yes.
I never heard this.
Well, sure. No, I mean, Prabhupada wanted that the GBC be Brahminical, but I have to ask, can it be? Yeah.
In
the current, yeah, maybe 100 years from now, but in the world we're living in now, the ISKCON we're living in now, can the GBC all of a sudden turn itself into a Brahminical body? I don't think it can. I think it's too caught up in managing.
That's another issue.
Who's going to manage?
Yeah. It's a question of job description.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other issue is that sometimes I found that there is this, we take for granted, or almost for granted, that managers are kshatriyas, but anybody who manages is not necessarily kshatriyas. Managers can be vaishyas, can be shudras.
Yes.
Managers means dealing with money, dealing with people, doing things through people.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily the one who is a manager is a kshatriya. Can
right.
be shudra, can be a vaishya.
Definitely. Yes.
Yeah, that's the point I want to make.
Yeah. Okay. No. The question is better rephrased. I mean, the real issue is we need Brahmins and Kshatriyas. We don't have anybody trained up properly to perform those functions purely. We haven't instituted the training for it. Even if you have the nature of a Brahmin or a Kshatriya, you don't become one without proper training first.
What's your point? That
Well, that it's in order to. I mean, what's needed is what's really needed is a beginning of establishing an educational system. You know, define these varna occupational functions, define the jobs, and then develop education, training for those jobs, and that's a very long-term job. So anyway, in the long run, I think that's what's required, is developing, understanding what's needed and then developing the training necessary for that. And then you may get 50 or 100 years from now, you may get people who can actually have been trained up and can perform the function. And I'm agreeing with you that it's not a simple question of, you know, something that GBC is going to do right now and solve the problem. Yes. The Brahmins have to understand what's a Brahmin, what's a Kshatriya, and the Brahmins have to train up the Kshatriyas. Then the Kshatriyas can do everything else, organize everybody else. The Brahmins have to create the Kshatriyas. But there are devotees, or there are those who would like to be devotees who can't chant 16 rounds, can't follow four regular principles, can't pick up a book, but they'd like to work for Krishna. For someone who doesn't read, who doesn't chant, who wants to do some service, in effect, that's a shudra. Yes. 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 But in each individual, that has to develop gradually. So some people are very much covered by the mode of ignorance, and it's going to take them some time to come up to the proper standard of sadhana bhakti. Maybe in this lifetime they can't. Maybe in this lifetime they may not be ready for real initiation. Maybe initiation shouldn't be given out so cheaply to those who can't. You know, initiation is being given out nowadays to devotees who don't even know what the four regulative principles are. You know, let us speak of being able to follow them. You know, many grihasthas, nobody ever told them about garbhadhara and samskara. So, I would think shudra is somebody who's not ready for initiation. Prabhupada did say, if you go 7 years without getting initiation, then you're a shudra. If you're practicing devotee but you don't take initiation for 7 years, you should consider yourself a shudra.
But that's if you don't have the standard of initiation.
Yes.
Not because you don't choose to do.
No, even that. Even
11 years.
Yes. Well, but it's also a matter of developing faith. If you may be following the principle, but you don't have enough trust to take initiation, to accept the guru, then that's also a weakness. I think he included that. I think he meant to include that. You know, that someone who can't put his trust in anybody, even after 7 years of practicing, that's a lower standard. There's something wrong with your faith. Yes. My father said, as soon as I met my guru, I accepted him as my spiritual master.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
He was ready for it.
Yes. Yes. No. Not that we should label. So, you know, okay, you've been hanging around for 7 years. You're a shooter. I don't mean like that. Yeah. But Prabhupada did make the statement. Yes. Why? Yes. It's not even necessary to tell anybody you're a shudra. You know, don't use the labels then. Maybe in a few generations, it'd be respectable to be considered a shudra. Nowadays, nobody wants to, you know, nobody will want to be called a shudra. So, okay, don't call anybody a shudra. But if someone can't follow principles but wants to work for Krishna, let him. You know, encourage him. Sure. He can become elevated by practicing Krishna consciousness in this lifetime. We have a half hour left. Maybe we can go back to the lesson plan. Otherwise, I'll fall behind. Anyway, thank you very much.
Torchlight.
Wow. Get the battery from what the run looks like. Look how it looks like. Look how it looks like. Really nice. Look how it looks like. 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 Man proposes, God disposes. Kardama, he says, Kardama just wanted a wife, that's all. Give me some wife, a suitable wife, whatever that is. But because he took his material desire and laid it at the feet of the Supreme Person, Lord Vishnu gave him fulfillment of his desire way beyond his expectations. He gave him a first-class princess for his wife. So, therefore, Prabhupada concludes in the purport, we should depend on the Lord's choice. We have material demands in our heart, in our mind. Offer them to Krishna. Let Krishna figure out the solution or the fulfillment of our desires. Let him make the choice. That's the best solution to dealing with material attachment. Then Prabhupada discusses toward the end of the purport about inter-caste marriage. That, we have to separate the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas. Brahmins and Kshatriyas have different occupations. They even live in different places. In a Vedic city, there'll be a neighborhood where the Brahmins live. The kings will live in the palaces and the royal neighborhood. They'll be separated physically. But there is intermarriage between Brahmins and Kshatriyas. That's allowed here. Kardama is being offered a Kshatriya girl. That's allowed. A Brahmin boy can marry a Kshatriya girl, but generally, the other way around is forbidden, generally, or it's considered not proper. A man should marry a wife who's equal to himself or inferior, not one who's materially superior. It doesn't work. The psychology doesn't work well. To have a wife who's materially smarter than you or higher class than you. And it's considered, it's called pratiloma. Anuloma is with the grain. You comb your hair, the direction the hair grows. If you comb your hair backwards and it gets all messed up, it's pratiloma, against the grain. When a kshatriya marries a Brahmin woman, that's against the grain. What's the result? What are the children of a marriage where the man is a kshatriya and the woman is a Brahmin? Suta, yeah. So Suta, that Suta is a mixed class, pratiloma. Suta Goswami talks about himself as pratilomaja. I was born against the grain, because he was born in the Suta class. And Sutas have, in each of these, there are, I think because you have four major varnas, you got 16 basic mixed classes. It's permutation, mathematical. So among them are the suttas, sons of originally born from a Brahmin father and a Kshatriya father and a Brahmin mother, and then their further descendants, those who were born of suttas, remain suttas. And the suttas have specific occupation: chariot drivers, and what else? Reciters of Puranas. Sutta Goswami, that was his family's occupation. His father, Romaharshana, was appointed by Vyasadeva to be the professor of the Puranas and the Itihasas. He was disposed of by Lord Balaram of Naimisharanya. And his son took his father's position on the Vyasasana at Naimisharanya, Ugra Shravasutta. That was the family occupation. They weren't chariot drivers, they were reciters of Puranas. Whereas Karna was adopted by Adirata, who was a chariot driver. So he was considered a Sutta, but his occupation was driving chariots. That's mixed. Pratiloma against the queen. But in this case, Kardama is going to marry a girl who's the next lower class, and that's okay, no problem. Prabhupada mentions the case of Yayati. Shukracharya's daughter wanted to marry Yayati. Yayati at first refused. I'm a king. She's the daughter of a sage. This is not proper. But Shukracharya said, no, do it. So with the special sanction of the father, this exceptional arrangement was made, that Yayati entered a pratiloma marriage. And there was trouble. They ran into trouble. Yayati ended up getting cursed. He lost his youth. Okay. So anyway, now we're being introduced to Devahuti, the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, mother of God, mother of Lord Kapiladev. In text 29, Lord Vishnu predicts how she'll beget 9 daughters. Yes? Yeah, a woman, okay, according to Dharma Shastra, a woman doesn't have her own caste. She, as a girl, she has the caste of her father. And when she gets married, she takes on the class of her husband. So the wife of a Brahmin is a Brahmani. Okay. Text 29.
Yata atma britam viryam navada pasavishyati virye tvadiye vishaya adasyanti anjasat manaha.
She will bring forth 9 daughters from the seed sown in her by you, and through the daughters you beget, the sages will duly beget children. So this in itself is fulfilling the order of Lord Brahma and helping the pastimes of Lord Vishnu to create and populate the universe. These 9 daughters of Kardama and Devahuti will marry the other principal Prajapatis. There wasn't that many qualified begetters of children available at that time, at the beginning of Brahma's day. So this is very significant, very important function they're going to perform. They're going to be mothers who are going to begin the great lines of kings, of demigods, of sages, and even of the different species of animals. These 9 daughters of Daksha, and then Kardama, and then Daksha will have many daughters, I think 22 or so daughters, who will marry the other Prajapatis. Kashyapa will marry 13 of the daughters of Daksha, and all the different species of life will be their children. 29. Okay, so Navada, it's described later on that Kardama Muni literally expanded himself into 9, and he impregnated his wife simultaneously in 9 different forms, and that way she had 9 daughters. A very competent yogi can do this. He can expand his body 9 times. Krishna expanded himself 16,108 times and went home every night to each of his wives in a separate palace. And each of those 16,108 Krishnas were doing different things at the same time. Whereas a yogi can expand himself up to 9 times, usually is the maximum. And each of those forms is basically just like a television image of the same person. They can't really perform separate functions. That's the limitation of a jiva. That's the best a jiva can do. Make 9
clones of himself.
So, by yogic power,
by the power of his austerity and discipline, Kardama is able to engage this sexual energy in a constructive way. Controlled sex means good children. When sex is not just indulged in for sense pleasure, when it's used for spirit, for the purposes of fulfilling one's duty in life, then the children are good. They become useful members of society. And Lord Vishnu is glorifying the daughters that are going to be born. So girls can also be auspicious. It's not just that only boys are auspicious offspring. Nowadays, medical technology has advanced, so you can go in almost any city, you can go get the ultrasound test to see whether your child's going to be a boy or a girl. And if she's a girl, you can kill it. So that's a very common thing nowadays in India. Just find out, and then if it's going to be a girl, just dispose of it. So these are the sins of the modern age. But in a civilized society, the girls are also honored. Their value is also respected. Okay. Can we go on to any questions or comments? No? Okay, text 30.
Tvam cha samyag anushtaya nidesham ma ushattamaha mai tirthi kritashesha kriyarto mam papatsyase.
Okay, now Lord Vishnu is going to switch the topic again. Okay, we arranged the marriage, that's taken care of, your desires are fulfilled. But now we'll discuss how you're going to attain spiritual perfection after that. So Vishnu then says, with your heart cleansed by properly carrying out my order, my command, resigning to me the fruits of all your acts, you will finally attain to me. In other words, Lord Vishnu is promising Kardama he's going to go back to Godhead. In this lifetime, he's going to attain the love of God. So,
mai tirti kvita shesha kriyardaha.
The word tirta, Prabhupada points out, in the purport, means a holy place, a pilgrimage, a sanctified, or he specifies, Prabhupada says, tirta means a sanctified place where charity is given. As in the first canto, chapter 13, when Vidura comes back home after wandering around in pilgrimage, he had been insulted by Duryodhana and left home. Now he's coming back after the Battle of Kurukshetra, after the Yadus have killed one another, and Krishna has actually left the planet. Now Vidura is coming home. And Yudhishthira greets him. He asks him, how was your pilgrimage? How did you find the holy places? Where did you go? And then before Vidura answers him, he says, well, anyway, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to tell me your whole itinerary.
Bhavad vidā bhagavata tirti bhūta swayam vibho.
Tirti kurvanti tirtani svantam stena gadā vritā. Great persons like yourself, Uncle Vidura, are yourselves real holy places. You go to these sacred places and you re-sanctify them by your personal presence, because you have Lord Gadabhrita, Krishna, the wielder of the transcendental club, Kaudomik, Kaumodiki, in your heart. So you come to these places carrying Krishna in your heart, and so many pilgrims have been visiting, bringing their, depositing their sins in the holy waters. You come and be repurified, and you make them back into holy places. You are the actual walking or mobile Tirtha. Kardama Muni also is like that. You will offer everything to me, resigning to me the fruits of all your acts, is the statement in the verse. Everything. Kardama is engaged in meditation. His meditation is an act of devotional service, so he's engaged in pure spiritual activity. At the same time, he's also engaged in material activity. He has the responsibility to help populate the universe. That means get married, take care of your wife, take care of your children. Now, material activity is involved. But all of that must be performed in Krishna consciousness for it to be actually successful. Even, Prabhupada discusses in the purport, even welfare work for one's family, society, country, humanity at large, all of that should be performed in Krishna consciousness, under the direction of the Supreme Lord and His representatives. So Prabhupada has made the point that we should do everything for Krishna, including our material duties. And in order to do that, we have to be acting under the direction of Krishna and of Krishna's representatives. So it's very important that what our activities, our behavior, has to be in line with the instructions of the acharyas. If not, then there'll be all sorts of disturbances and disappointments. This is my comment, not Prabhupada's. We can have a strong desire to become Krishna's devotees. We may have a strong taste for chanting Hare Krishna, but if our behavior is not up to a civilized standard, if we're not following the specific instructions of Prabhupada and his predecessors, then there's all sorts of trouble. Especially if we're full of doubts and we're wasting our energy fighting and criticizing one another, that destroys any sense of Krishna conscious community. Doubt and criticism and conflict. That's the importance of having Brahminical culture. When the Brahmins are there and everybody trusts what they have to say, then that pacifies the human society. Then there's not so much unnecessary quarreling. Then there's a mood of trust. Now, let the Kshatriyas be passionate. Let the Vaishyas be greedy. That's the way they are. But if you have some men who are above that, then that, you know, creates trust and a willingness to accept authority in society. And without that, without a willingness to accept proper authority, then human society is not civilized. Okay. Any questions or comments? Okay. So the point here is that Kshatriyas need the guidance of Brahmins. Human society, the whole society needs Brahmins to guide them. But especially the ones who are doing the ruling, they need personal guidance. They have to have a very intimate relationship with the Brahmins, and they have to be the disciples. The Brahmins have something to say, and the Kshatriyas should be listening. So I have some quotations from the Vedas on this point. But the Kshatriyas especially need to be guided by the Brahmins. Okay. Some of them I have the Sanskrit, some I just have translation. Again, from that Shatapatha Brahmana, the explanatory commentary on the White Yajurveda. So the statement in chapter 26 of the Shatapatha Brahmana, that a Brahmana may remain without a king, but a king should never be without a Brahmana.
Brahmins can just live out in the forest. They can live an anarchistic life. They don't need to be ruled. But a king without a Brahmin to guide him is not a proper Kshatriya.
Okay. Then going back to the Rig Veda, right from the Rig Veda Samhita, fourth mandala, chapter 50. Sa it kshetri sudita okasi sve tasmai ila pinrate vishwadanim tasmai visham svayam eva namante yasmin ramha rajani purva eti.
That king dwells in full satisfaction in his own residence. For him, the earth is always fruitful, and to him, the citizens spontaneously, voluntarily bow down. That king who keeps in front of himself the Brahmins, the king who is always faithful to Brahminical culture, who honors the Brahmins and takes their advice. He's satisfied. The earth is prosperous. The citizens voluntarily submit to him. Okay, that's a Rig Veda. So it shouldn't be said that the Vedas don't discuss the Varnashram system. It's right there. It's just not, chapter by chapter in systematic order. But there's plenty of information about the Vedic social system in the Vedas. From the Aitareya Brahmana, the explanation of the Rig Veda, chapter 8 of the Aitareya Brahmana.
Tadyatra vai brahmana kshatram vasham eti tadrashtram samvidam tadviravad ahasmin viro jayate.
In that kingdom where the Brahmins have control over the Kshatriyas, there is prosperity. That kingdom is heroic, a place where heroes are born. And again from the Shatapatha Brahmana, 5th chapter, part 4.
Yovai Raja Brahmanad Abil Abaliyan Amitrebyo Vai Sabaliyan Bhavati.
Off everybody. Not everybody. No, everybody. The king who is not powerful toward the Brahmins, in other words, who is humble to the Brahmins, becomes very powerful to his foes. So if the king, in other words, if the king is respectful to the Brahmins, then he gets the strength to defeat his enemies. Okay. Then another topic that I have a few verses or quotations on is the idea that Brahman is always superior to the Kshatriya. So also in the original Vedas, Taittiriya Samhita, that's the Vaishnavas associate themselves with that branch of the Black Yajur Veda. So in the Taittiriya Samhita, chapter 2, the statement,
Brahman eva kshatram anvaram vayati tasmad brahmano mukyo mukyo bhavati.
The Brahmana places the Kshatriya behind himself. He assumes a superior position. Thus, the Brahman is most important. He is born from the mouth, of Brahma.
Punjabi Hai.
And then in the Aitareya Brahmana,
Bhuyan Vai Brahmana Kshatriyad Iti Varuna Uvacha.
Varuna has said that the Brahman is superior to the Kshatriya.
Brahman, and from the Tandya Brahmana that belongs to the Samaveda, Brahman hi purvam kshatrat.
The Brahman has priority over the Kshatriya.
So that's a basic principle of the Vedic system. Yeah.
What is the they must have some practical independence, something like kshatriya. What is the actual control line? Like, they must have some practical administration of this.
Oh, no, no. No, that's up to him. He should maintain, the king should maintain a Brahminical council of advisors. And whenever he's doubtful about the right thing to do, then he asks them. But it's not that he has to, ask them, how to brush his teeth and every little thing.
But is it specifically
for spiritual functions? No, practical things. But, because the day-to-day functioning of a kshatriya is a matter of executing the principles of religion, dharma. It's not just politics. It's Brahman. A kshatriya lives to defend and promulgate dharma. So if there's any question about what's dharmic, what's the right thing to do, he has to go to the Brahmins if he's in doubt. Anyway, the minimum is every day when the kshatriya wakes up in the morning, he has to offer respects to the Brahmins. One of the first things he does in the morning before he brushes his teeth is pay respect. That's the minimum. You have to at least show respect to the Brahmins in the morning. And maybe if you go to the whole day without having any questions, okay, but you still have to make that show of offering respect. But he can't, kshatriya can't perform a sacrifice without consulting and engaging the Brahmins. There's not much he can do without involving some of the Brahmins. Practically, he can't go a whole day without consulting. Okay, anything else? Okay, so it's time to stop here. Thank you all. Glorious to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhagavatam. Did everybody get chapter 22?
But he's also an exemplary Brahmana.
Not every Brahmana is a devotee, a Vaishnava, but every pure Vaishnava is automatically a Brahmana. So compassion. Dayajiveshu. This is certainly a necessary qualification for a Vaishnava. Prabhupada explains, to be a second class Vaishnava. You cannot be a second class Vaishnava, Madhyama Adhikari, unless you have compassion for the conditioned souls. You won't care to preach. You won't have any interest in preaching if you don't feel concern for other people's suffering. If you're only interested in your own salvation, then you won't bother to come to the second class platform. You'll remain a Kanishna Adhikari. So that's Baba's explanation. And on a more ordinary level, looking at the qualifications of a Brahmana or a Kshatriya, concern for the general population, for their welfare. This is what characterizes Brahmins and Kshatriyas. They want to selflessly advance the welfare of human society. Vaishyas are not interested in that. But when you have Vaishyas or Shudras running the government, then you have selfish, corrupt politicians, in effect. Then everything is correct. You have to have noble people. So both the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas share this noble quality of compassion. Only because they have such elevated consciousness and proper behavior, sadachar, are the Kshatriyas and Brahmins able to have any compassion. A person who is indulging in sinful activities cannot feel compassion, especially those kill animals who, these four basic principles of sinful life. If you're killing animals, if you're taking intoxication, if you're gambling, if you're indulging in illicit sex, then you lose your sense of compassion, a feeling for anybody else. If you're killing, the unborn child in your own semen or in the womb, to waste your semen is murder. So this pure Vaishnava, rather the Pukka Brahmins, traditionally, when a man passes away, they do the antyeshti, funeral ceremony, but part of that is a special ritual for Brunhatya, the atonement for his having wasted semen during his life. It's killing living entities in the semen. What to speak of those who indulge in abortion and other abominations. We come from a culture where violence and abominable activities are just a way of life. So we come from a culture, therefore, that can't really feel compassion. It's only because we've been touched by the association of a pure devotee that we've been lifted up out of this selfishness. We should be very careful not to revert back to our selfish ways. If we feel any compassion, if we feel any urge to preach, it's only because pure devotee is injected at us, that in us. It's not our conditioned nature at all to feel any compassion for anybody. But that compassion is our ticket to pure devotional service. We're able to come to the functional platform of Madhyama Adhikaris because we can feel the urge to preach, to benefit others. Anyway, the Brahmin Kshatriyas, each in their own way, are kritva dayam cha jiveshu, trying to be merciful to the conditioned souls. Kshatriyas, we'll read in a few verses about how the Kshatriya works for the benefit of others. He's a protector. He defends the pious by subduing the wicked. That means he uses violence, he uses force to protect the citizens. That's his way of showing compassion. A Brahmin is trying to do the same thing, but he has a different methodology. A Brahmin doesn't deal in force. He deals in knowledge. He teaches, he studies and he teaches. And by his teachings, he's giving fearlessness. Madhyama Adhikari preaches. Prabhupada mentions also even the Uttama Adhikari, because he knows the real position of fearlessness from direct realization. He's not just talking Shastra, but he sees Krishna face to face. The lotus feet of Krishna are directly realized experience for him. So he knows what fearlessness is. So when the Uttama Adhikari, when the Paramahamsa announces, yes, we can all be fearless, that's the most convincing. But the Uttama Adhikari empowers his disciples, the Madhyama Adhikaris, to also pass on that message of fearlessness. So the Brahmins, whether they're Vaishnavas or some other class of Brahmins, in general, they're meant to elevate other human beings from animal life, from the fearlessness of forgetting their spiritual identity, the fearfulness. The fearful condition we're talking about is human beings living like animals, forgetting that they're servants of God, forgetting that they're human beings. So to deliver everybody from fearlessness, the Brahmins teach the truth according to their own realization. Prabhupada makes the comment, the purport, compassion is required to properly use God's energy for one's real self-interest. The Vaishyas think they're smart. They're getting collecting all the money. They think that they're working for the self-interest and these foolish Brahmins are just sitting around begging. But they don't understand that just putting money in the bank is not really the way you gain your true self-interest. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas are actually working for their own self-interest and for that of others because they have a broader vision. Anyway, without that, even somebody who's trying to practice devotional service remains a Kanishadihari forever until he develops dayab jiveshu, compassion for the conditioned souls. Ultimately, Prabhupada says this fear that someone like Gautama delivers us from is the fear of dying in forgetfulness of God. Then in the second half of the verse, after mentioning the more important accomplishments that Gautama has achieved, there's chair, plenty of chairs here. Take a chair to sit in there. Self-realized, Atmavan, Mayatmanam Sahajagat Drakshasi. You will see. Maybe you haven't achieved that ultimate perfection yet, but you, Kartama, are very quickly on the path toward quick perfection. And you will, if not already, you will see the whole world, including yourself, are all contained within me. How is that? It's not according the way it is in the Mayavadi misconception that everything is one, that there are no distinctions. No, God, Prabhupada emphasizes, no, God is a separate person, everybody else is separate, but everybody and everything belongs to God. Everything is God's property. So in that sense, everything is in the Supreme Person. Everything is related to Him and is meant to be used in His service. Kartama has or very soon will fully realize that understanding. And then also the counterpart of that, you will also see me within yourself. God is everywhere. Everything is God's energy. But you can also find God in your own heart. There's a very intimate, personal connection there. Not that just God is the cosmic master, and He's so important and He's so busy with everybody else that you can't have an intimate relationship with Him. No, He's sitting in your heart. He's waiting for you to turn your attention to Him. You're too busy, not that He's too busy to deal with you. You're too busy to deal with Him. And when you put aside all your material busyness, He's been sitting in your heart forever waiting for you. This analogy of the two birds in the tree. Dvau suparno sayuja sakaya. Two friends, two birds who are sitting on the same tree, but one of them is busy trying to enjoy the fruits of the tree. And the other one is waiting for his friend to turn his attention back to him. This is actually from the Rig Veda. It's quoted, Prabhupada quotes it from the Mundak Upanishad, but it also originally occurs in the Rig Veda itself, this verse. So the philosophy of the difference between the Jivatma and Paramatma is there in the Rig Veda. It's original Vedic philosophy, not something new, not some medieval bhakti, you know, bhakti creation. It goes all the way back to the beginning of time. And that oneness of the two birds is their oneness of purpose. Manmana, Krishna teaches at the end of the Gita, Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto Madhyaji Imam Namaskuru. Just be my devotee, worship me, think of me all the time, and submit to me. And then you'll come to me. Your life will become perfect. So, anyway, in this verse, Lord Vishnu is promising Kartama, you may have a little further to go, but you're practically there. You've practically realized this perfection already. So, although he's sending Kartama out to go get married, get entangled in family life, indulge in material sense gratification, but don't worry, because you're going to be coming to me very soon. Okay. One point being made here, Brahmins and Kshatriyas are compassionate for the conditioned souls. There's one statement from the Shatapata Brahmana again. We've quoted from it four or five times already. The Brahmana that explains the White Yajurveda, the Vajrasayani Samhita, 100 chapters of the Shatapatra Brahmana, and the 6th chapter is a statement. I don't have the Sanskrit. The Brahmins and the Kshatriyas enclose or envelop the Vaishyas and the Shudras. But this doesn't mean that they simply subjugate the Vaishyas and the Shudras. That's the caste system. But it means that they protect. The Vaishyas and the Shudras don't have the strength to maintain themselves without the protection of both the Kshatriyas and the Brahmins. The Kshatriyas give the physical support, the protection against violence of criminals and tyrants. And the Brahmins protect them from ignorance by giving them spiritual instruction and guidance, and before helping them engage in performing of sacrifice. Okay. Then we'll look at verse 32. Here, Lord Vishnu further predicts that the personality of Godhead is also going to take birth as a son of Kartika. Okay, now a promising liberation. That's not all. Before you get your liberation, you will have the pleasure of having the Supreme Person of me becoming your son. Lord Narayana is promising, I'm going to become your son also. Is that verse 32?
Sahaham swam shakalaya tvadviryena mahamune tavakshetre devahutyam praneshye tatva samhitam.
O great sage, I shall manifest my own plenary portion through your wife Devahuti, along with your 9 daughters, and I shall instruct her in the system of philosophy that deals with the ultimate principles or categories. Okay, that's yes, Swamsha Kalaya. So Prabhupada discusses in the purport this terminology, Swamsha Kalaya. Lord Kapiladev is a partial incarnation. He's Vishnu himself, but when we talk about Amshas, the Lord's personal partial incarnations, it doesn't mean that they're less than God, but God is not showing his full personality. He's not showing all of his opulences, all of his glories. When he appears as Matsyadev or Varahadev, he's not displaying his personality as fully as he does when he appears as Krishna, Ramachandra, even Vamanadev. He's holding back a lot of his personality, not showing it. So similarly, Kapiladev is mostly showing a certain aspect of his personality. He's the ideal teacher. He's giving instruction. You don't see Kapiladev having Rasa Leela or killing demons. He's not displaying those pastimes. He's sitting down with his mother and giving her spiritual instruction in this philosophy that deals with the ultimate principles or categories, Sankhya philosophy. Tattva Samhita, the science of the elements, tattvas. Analysis of nature, of existence into its elements, material and spiritual elements. So that's what Kapiladev teaches. Okay. And Kartika is glorious because he's a perfect Brahmin, because he's worshipped the Lord successfully for 10,000 years. Now he's promised he's earned liberation by his sadhana, but also by his devotion. The Lord has agreed to become his son. So Kartika is glorified by that, and his wife Devahuti, he hasn't even met her yet. Who's Devahuti? He doesn't know. He never met her, this girl. He'll meet her in 2 days. But it's already been predicted that she will be glorified as him. She will be also the mother of God. Okay, so we look at the next verse. Okay, everybody
That point is the end of Vishnu's address to Kardama. So are there any comments or questions at that point? Yeah. Yes, because the 25th and the 26th elements in Kapila Dev's list are the Jivatma and the Paramatma. The atheistic Kapila Dev doesn't identify the Jiva the same way as we do. The atheistic system, there's a Purusha, but that Purusha is totally inactive. He doesn't do anything. He's conscious, but he has no activity. All activity in the atheistic Kapila system is performed by Prakriti alone. Prakriti is active, but not conscious. And the Purusha is conscious, but not active. And the two of them combined, and then there's material creation. There's no God and there's no Jiva as we know him. Because we understand the Jiva as a knower and a doer. He's a small knower. He only knows something. And he only does a few things. But he does have, in part, the powers of the Supreme Soul. It's different. The atheistic system is a whole different system. And what people think is Sankhya philosophy is this atheistic system. That was taught much later by somebody else who took the same name. Anyway, the system of Kapila, the son of Devahuti, there are also those two spiritual elements. Okay? And that's, without that, then the system is not much use. The whole idea is to realize yourself as spirit soul and to realize the Supreme Spirit. Otherwise, what's the use of wasting your time analyzing material nature? It's only it's a ladder leading up to understanding all this whole creation is very wonderful and perfectly designed. Where is the intelligence that designed it? So the understanding of the intelligent structure of the universe leads you to want to discover the intelligence of the person who has that intelligence. Okay, yeah. Anything else? And then we look at verse 33 then. Maitreya Uvacha Evam Tam Anupashyata Bhagavan Pratyat Akshajaha Jagama Bindu Sarasa Sarasvatiya Parishvita.